Willkommen, liebe Zuhörerinnen, zu einer weiteren Folge des One Health Podcasts. Mein Name ist Dana Thal und ich bin Geschäftsführerin der One Health Plattform am Friedrich-Löffler-Institut. Der Mensch verändert den Planeten in rasender Geschwindigkeit, indem er den Klimawandel befeuert, Wälder rodet, Moore trockenlegt, Flächen versiegelt, Flüsse umleitet und vieles mehr. Das hat Auswirkungen auf die Artengemeinschaften von Tieren. Auch von denen unserer nächsten Verwandten, den Primaten. Diese Artengemeinschaften bestehen aber nicht nur aus Tieren, sondern auch aus einer Vielzahl an Mikroorganismen. Welche Auswirkungen und eine Veränderung der Zusammensetzung von Tiergemeinschaften auf ihre mikrobiellen Gemeinschaften, Krankheiten und Übertragungsraten haben kann, darüber sprechen wir in der heutigen Folge. Und dies ist eine besondere Folge, denn ich werde das Interview heute auf Englisch führen. Wenn Sie im Nachgang zu der Folge noch eine deutsche Übersetzung zu dem Interview wünschen, dann schreiben Sie uns gerne an info@onehealthplattform.net. Dann schauen wir, dass wir Ihnen noch eine deutsche Zusammenfassung zur Verfügung stellen. Okay, so I switch to English and introduce our interviewee of today, that is Dr. Jan Gogarden. He actually started studying biology at the McGill University in Canada. He then moved on to do his master's in the Department of Anthropology at the Stony Brook University in the USA. He then moved back to Canada to do his PhD, again at the Department of Biology. After that, he had different postdoctoral fellowships at the Robert Koch Institute, the Helmholtz Institute for One Health, as well as the University of Greifswald. And since 2023, he is the junior research group leader at the Evolutionary Community Ecology Research Group at the Helmholtz Institute for One Health. So welcome to the One Health podcast, Jan.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about your research. A large part of your research deals with primates. And I'd like to know, how did you come to this research topic and what fascinates you about doing research on primates?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, as an undergraduate student, I was interested in anthropology and biology. And primatology was kind of a way to combine those interests to understand human evolution and use studies of our closest living relatives to understand ourselves. So sort of using them as a mirror to understand how we became to be who we are and why we are the way we are. Mm. And towards the end of my bachelor's at McGill University, I was able to do a semester in Panama with the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute there. And that provided me this chance to sort of work in tropical ecosystems and start to see primates in their natural ecosystems. And while I was at STRI, I was working with electric fishes to understand how they can sort of see the environment and create maps of the environment. And then sort of wrapping up my undergraduate degree, I started sort of working as a field biologist for hire and first studying wild birds and bird behavior and ecology, and then sort of got hooked on primates after joining a program in Costa Rica studying wild capuchin monkeys. Mm. And there we would sort of wake up in the morning and follow them along their day, and you would see them take plants and rub them on their body and sort of these group grooming sessions. And there were all these questions started to come up, you know, why this behavior? Is it self-medication? Are these sort of cultures that we're seeing, so certain groups doing certain behaviors, and how does that influence sort of their biology and their behavior? And then obviously there's the sort of coming with that, seeing animals in the wild and having that opportunity to study sort of animals in their natural ecosystems came sort of the threats that those primates face as well. So habitat loss and destruction and sort of the threats from a conservation perspective that also started to sort of move my research interests.
Yeah, totally understandable. I mean, already when you do see primates in the zoo, I think that's already really fascinating. And seeing them in wildlife where they actually have like their natural behavior must be so much more fascinating. Primates, of course, like all living beings on our planet, they do not live in isolation, but in complex ecosystems. And when we think of ecosystems, we normally just think of animals and plants living there. However, microorganisms are also very important components of these ecosystems. So what role do microorganisms play in the health and the evolution of primates?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I was sort of starting to work with non-human primates, one of the first questions that really interested me was, so primates are special, like humans in that many of them live in these large social groups and these permanent associations. And one of the big questions that sort of moved me during my PhD research was understanding how that sociality and how that living in groups influences the biology of animals and the transmission of pathogens and what microorganisms can exist in the group. Those kinds of questions moved me to try to understand exactly those questions. So how do these microorganisms play a role in the health and the well-being of communities? How are they maintained? Are there different microorganisms that exist in primate social groups, so in wild groups of chimpanzees in West Africa or in groups of red colobus in East Africa? And so what is it about sort of their biology and their ecology living in these social groups, but also in these complex ecosystems? So that's sort of the advantage of being able to study them in the wild that influences those microorganism communities. And yeah, so I mean, there's one part of that, which is pathogens. So the parts of the community that are sort of clearly associated with health, where the effects are more obvious. And their studies of wild primates, they give these insights into what are those pathogens in those ecosystems that could be relevant for human health. So we use them a bit like sentinel systems, where we can sort of discover the parts of those ecosystems that might be potentially relevant for human health in terms of microbial communities. So there are things like Ebola viruses that might be circulating in an ecosystem that we didn't know anything about in West Africa, sort of before the West African Ebola epidemic. And, you know, when chimpanzees die of Ebola and you can discover that virus in that ecosystem, it gives you an insight or heads up that those pathogens are there and circulating. So there's those naturally occurring pathogens that spill over into great apes or into primate populations that are interesting and very relevant, obviously, for their health as well. From the conservation perspective, there's also a lot of human pathogens that can spill over into great ape and primate populations. So there are things like human respiratory diseases are one of the big ones. So Fabian Lendatz, the head of the Helmholtz Institute for One Health, he discovered that, you know, over 15 years ago now, that human respiratory diseases were spilling over into great ape populations and causing mortality. And so trying to come up with ways to prevent those kinds of spillover events to sort of create a space where great apes can still live in the wild, even if we're coming into sort of closer contact by watching them in the wild. And so those are sort of the two from the pathogen side of things. But then, like you mentioned, there's this whole community of organisms that are naturally occurring, just like humans who have, you know, rich microbial communities in their guts and on their skin and sort of everywhere on their bodies. So do primates. And that's where having this ability to sample across different groups of non-human primates really gives us insights into sort of what is the normal microbiome for primates and how has the microbiome along the human lineage changed and adapted? And how does that potentially sort of interact with health and susceptibility to pathogens and to things like allergies and those kind of big questions about sort of what is it that we've changed along the human lineage by changing the way we live, the foods we eat, the diversity of sort of plants and animals that we interact with in our daily lives? How has that influenced our microbiomes? And there we found that humans really seem to have lost a lot of microbial diversity. So they've lost a lot of bacteria that have been associated with primates for a long time. So the microorganisms have even co-diverged with their hosts. So when the hosts split up in the deeper past, each of them took with them one version of this microorganisms, and that association has been maintained for millions of years of evolutionary history. So we have these long-term associations that are passed down from generation to generation within these ecosystems. And the same is true for the viruses of those bacteria. So it's like Russian dolls, those Matryoshka dolls, that the viruses of the bacteria also have these long-term associations. And humans seem to have lost a lot of that diversity. And that's sort of an exciting next frontier is understanding, you know, what does that mean? What does that change for humans? And are there parts of that diversity that might be useful for various aspects of human health?
Yeah, you definitely choose a research topic where there are many, many questions that still can be answered. Clever choice. You already mentioned it's not only that we as humans, we influence also the primates because we can also like transmit diseases to them, but we are also changing their habitats because we are cutting down the bush or doing many, many things to the environment. So the habitats also change. And what effects do changes in the species communities then have on the occurrence and transmission of microorganisms?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, there's a lot of open and big questions to be asked there. But so one of the key hypotheses about sort of that relationship between biodiversity and health is this idea of the dilution hypothesis. So it's the idea that as biodiversity increases, that reduces the prevalence of pathogens that are relevant for human health. and sort of by increasing the diversity of species, you maybe reduce the likelihood that there's sort of one nasty pathogen that infects all of those species at the same time. So it maybe reduces the likelihood of certain diseases to emerge into humans. I would say there's a lot of hypotheses about how changes in biodiversity and changes in animal density influence diseases, but there's not a ton of data. So that's one of the things that the group is really excited to start to contribute is being able to measure biodiversity and biodiversity change in ecosystems where we're also monitoring primate populations and can start to sort of monitor health and diseases in those populations.
So with this dilution, it would be a bit like, okay, when there's more competition between maybe viruses because there are just more, there is not like one virus that can become dominant.
Yep.
Oh, okay. So we need a lot of biodiversity in order to not have like one big pathogen arising.
Yeah, so that's, I would say it's a hypothesis, and whether that plays out in every ecosystem all the time is a big question. And I think it's also something where I'm really excited that there's sort of with this One Health movement and sort of trying to sort of understand human health in the context of ecosystem health and animal health, this opportunity, I really do see it as an opportunity to include sort of health in our discussions about conservation. So we have this idea, okay, there's this 30 by 30 goal that we should preserve 30% of all ecosystems by 2030. But that also means preserving ecosystems that are reservoirs for pathogens. And so that should be part of our discussion about, okay, we're preserving biodiversity, and biodiversity, it does good things, and there may be some dilution hypothesis and those kinds of ideas, but changing those landscapes and changing where biodiversity sits in relation to humans and how humans are coming into contact with it also comes with risks. And I think sort of having an open discussion about that and then also providing communities who are now involved in sort of conservation on a large scale and interacting with biodiversity in new ways, giving them tools so that they can sort of mitigate that risk and understand that risk and provide sort of data to inform decision making, I would see as a really large scale goal of the Hamilton Institute for One Health.
Yeah. And however this dilution hypothesis will turn out in the end, I think it will probably be a good idea to give wildlife some space to live and to reduce interfaces, because interfaces are always an opportunity for a pathogen to jump species barriers. So you are working with wildlife, and that is a bit more complicated than working with lab animals, because you can't just like take blood samples or something. So you probably have to rely on non-invasive samples. So how can pathogens then be detected from like different sample types that you're using? I don't know, like probably feces or carcasses. I don't know. What samples do you use, and how do you get the pathogens out?
Yeah, so we really use a diversity of anything we can get from these ecosystems to get insights into the pathogens that are circulating, either within a group of primates or in a landscape. So yeah, like you mentioned, things like fecal samples. 20 years ago, it wouldn't have been imaginable that, you know, we could screen for RNA viruses well in fecal samples, but the methods really have improved a lot, and it takes a bit more sampling and a bit more time in the lab, but we can sort of pull out these tiny little fragments of viruses. So things like the simian foamy virus or simian immunodeficiency virus, we can, using either PCRs to find short fragments of the pathogens that we're interested in, using sort of generic primers so we can detect new diversity, but we can also increasingly use sort of next generation sequencing tools. So things like, we use a lot of hybridization capture in our group. So that's we synthesize RNA baits that are complementary to the pathogens that we're interested in. Mm-hmm. And then we biotinylate those baits. So then we can sort of bind those with streptivity-encoded magnetic beads. So essentially it's sort of like fishing for the nucleic acids that we're interested in. And then we can wash away everything that doesn't bind to those baits and then see what sticks and then sequence that's left. And using those kinds of tools, we can now sort of generate whole genomes even from sort of the viruses that are infecting the host when it's shed in feces. So those kinds of tools have really changed the amount of data and the amount of information we can get from non-invasive samples. So even from museum bone collections, things that people collected, you know, 100 years ago, people are pulling out fragments of DNA from different bacterial or viral infections, but even RNA viruses increasingly. So we're pushing back sort of that frontier with those methods that we can look into the past as well, which is quite neat.
So the methods became more sensitive, and you also like need less material to start with. Or
yeah, okay. Exactly. So you can really go to that needle in the haystack.
Yeah.
So it's like really finding that, those last few pieces of very fragmented nucleic acid that, you know, before the next generation sequencing revolution, you know, PCR wouldn't have been able to amplify because the pieces were so fragmented. Mm. And now with these sort of, with those next generation sequencing techniques, you can even enrich and sequence very, very small pieces that are left in a sample.
And do you need to have an idea first what you are looking for if you are designing these baits, or can you also do the baits that they find anything and then you can sequence in the end and see, find also something new?
Yeah. So these enrichment techniques, they typically work by finding things that are complementary to the thing that you put into the bait design.
Yeah.
And so there, having some idea what you're looking for really is a critical part of sort of designing the bait sets. The nice thing about those bait sets is they can enrich things that are up to, 30, 40% divergence from those sequences. So they still stick. And so you can still enrich things that are quite dissimilar from things that you know. And the other option is obviously working without enrichment. So you can use untargeted methods where you just chuck on sequence a sample, and then because costs have gone down so much for sequencing, you can sort of sequence through all of the other DNA or RNA that's there.
Yeah, that's really cool. When I was doing my bachelor's, I think it was, I was also doing some sequencing, and it was always like, okay, it has to be all perfect. We just have like one. It's too expensive to do more. And I was always so nervous when I was loading the sequence, like, oh, I hope I did everything correctly. Yeah, easier now, I guess. And you also use flies as sampling material. And what is the idea behind this and how does that work?
Yeah, so already a decade ago, Sebastian Cavagnac Spencer and Ida Schnell in Copenhagen and others, they had this idea that sort of to get high quality DNA from mammals or animals in an ecosystem, one cool source might be the animals that come into contact with either the byproducts of those animals or the animals themselves as part of their life cycle. Mm-hmm. So there are things like leeches or flies that sort of, go to carrion. So carrion flies that find dead animals in the forest were a neat first thing that they checked. And indeed, that sort of my own work and Seb's work and many others, they've shown that works really well. So if you take 100 flies in a tropical ecosystem, you get a DNA sample from all of the diurnal primates that are living in that ecosystem. So 13, 14 different primate species. So, they really come into contact with primates, either their byproducts or the dead animals, quite frequently. And the methods are quite sensitive, so we can sort of detect the DNA of those species quite easily. And with flies and leeches, we've also shown that you can even generate the mitochondrial genome of the primates from the flies. So you can just collect a bunch of flies in an ecosystem and say, okay, what's the mitochondrial diversity for, the baboons or the red colobus monkeys or the chimpanzees that we find in those ecosystems. So it's kind of a quite amazing sampling tool for understanding, what biodiversity is in those ecosystems. So what mammals or what primates or what vertebrates are in those ecosystems. Well, doing my PhD, so I was sort of following monkeys in the forest and sort of had this toolkit in mind, and we were using it to sample biodiversity to understand what flies are in this ecosystem. And one of the sort of questions I had was, okay, how are these flies really coming into contact with primates? So are they just flying around all the time? Are they sort of randomly distributed in the ecosystem? Or like with humans and their livestock, are there these associations with hosts, essentially?
Hmm.
And so we were waiting for the monkeys to come down so we could follow them and collect health data and sort of observe them and collect samples. We noticed that there were a lot of flies flying around and going to fecal samples. And so we conducted this mark recapture experiment where we captured the flies and we put them on ice packs in the field. They stopped moving. And then we took nail polish that we took from one of the assistants in camp and a little pipette, and we marked them in the field just as sort of a little simple experiment to see, are those flies staying with a group when the group then moves kilometers through the forest. And we were kind of surprised to find that we were finding many of the flies that we had marked up to 2 weeks later with the group. So they really move through the forest.
Yeah.
And they sort of have these long-term associations with a primate social group. And then we checked how fly density changes with group sizes, and we found larger groups have more flies with them. So it might be the sort of cost of sociality that's sort of like humans being with sort of livestock being an extreme example where you have these really high fly densities with really large group sizes. And then sort of the next question was, okay, what about disease? Can they tell us something about the diseases in that specific group of monkeys? And there, for certain pathogens, flies work really well. If you take flies in a group of sooty mangabeys, and in that group, there was an anthrax death from Bacillus cereus biovaranthracis, so this new anthrax that circulates in that ecosystem. You know, a week later, if you capture flies in that group of mangabeys, you find the exact isolate that killed a mangabey a week before. So you can really sequence the exact pathogen that killed a monkey in that group. Or you can detect, you know, if you capture 100 flies in the group of monkeys, we had 5 that had the Treponema pallidum. That's a bacterium that's responsible for Yaw's disease in humans. And we had animals in the group who were sick. And we were able to detect that pathogen in the flies as well. So it can be a really neat snapshot for certain bacterial pathogens in that group of specific monkeys. We can also use that then across landscapes. So you can imagine, okay, you know, you don't have a monkey group everywhere that's used to people. So that's one of the challenges of working with monkeys and apes. They're initially very afraid of humans. And so it takes a long time and primatologists working for, you know, years and years to get them used to humans. And so the nice thing with flies is you can suddenly sample where you don't have primatologists running around. So you can get insights into, you know, how is anthrax distributed across the landscape just by capturing flies, and then start to get insights into, because you can also get information on not just the pathogen, but what hosts that specific fly came into contact with. So you can say, you know, what's the host range of anthrax? Because, you know, only those flies that fed on a carcass will have anthrax. And so you can start to sort of unravel bits of the ecology of the pathogen just using fly iDNA, which is quite neat.
That is really cool. So how does this then stick to the flies? Is it on their legs, or do they take up some food and also take up the pathogens? Then how does it stick to the flies?
Yeah, so they do have these hairs on their legs, yeah. which is probably one source. And then, they have, like you mentioned, they're ingesting and regurgitating. And so that's where, so with monkeypox, there was also flies that were captured immediately next to a carcass and sort of where they were regurgitating. So they do this sort of regurgitating and resucking up of their meals. And there on the spots that were on the leaves, you could even find sort of viable monkeypox virus. So it's kind of a surprising what flies get into.
Yeah, definitely. Can they also serve as vectors then of the disease?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of open questions there. So there's good hints with certain eukaryotic parasites, so like movement of eggs that they can really transmit, and certain bacterial pathogens. I would say there's also pretty good evidence that they can really be involved as a vector. For things like the Bacillus cereus biovaranthracis, the sylvatic anthrax, or Treponema pallidum, the pathogen responsible for Yaws that we saw in that monkey group, I would say there's more questions than answers. So there's some old studies from the past that suggest they may play a role. And for classic anthrax, there's some hints that sort of insects may play a role when they come into contact with carcasses and spreading the pathogen to surrounding vegetation that then browsers can come into contact with again. But yeah, there's a need for more studies to really sort of conclusively say, but we have viable anthrax in the flies. So it's really like, you can culture it. It's there in quite high amounts.
Okay. So really good workforce you found there. It's very efficient, much better than just sending many PhD students to follow the monkeys. Cool method, definitely. So you said you can also then say something about the biodiversity, because you also find like material from other species that roam around the forest. And
yeah, exactly. So that's sort of actually how our interest in flies started, was really this, like, can we use carrion flies that we detect? You know, you put out a little piece of meat and many flies come flying in. Can you use them as samplers for the species that are in a specific ecosystem? Mm. We actually had sort of thinking about sort of methods to describe biodiversity. 2 years ago, we were in the jungle and we were sort of studying whether just with air filters, so just filtering the air, whether that would be enough material to already say what species are present in an ecosystem. We were comparing that with flies. So we were also collecting flies, and sort of while waiting for the flies and the people who were building up the air samplers to collect the air samples, we decided to try just swabbing the vegetation. If there's DNA flying around in the air, we thought maybe, you know, and the flies are landing on the vegetation, maybe there's enough DNA sticking to plant vegetation to also give us insights into the biodiversity that's in an ecosystem. And that worked surprisingly well. So with a single swab of tropical leaves, so you spend 3 minutes swabbing leaves, you break it off, you put it into a tube, you throw it in your backpack and you're done. So it's super simple to collect. You don't need any equipment. You don't need any training. And each swab contained the DNA of 8 different genera of vertebrates. So you were getting DNA of birds, of rodents, of bats. And so you have this really simple biodiversity monitoring tool that we're really excited about sort of scaling out. So if, you know, you can think about conservationists who are trying to protect a remaining forest patch to say, okay, just go and collect 100 swabs. and we'll get sort of a snapshot of the biodiversity there. We're thinking about health and sort of linking biodiversity to health. We have these human health cohorts that are starting now in sub-Saharan Africa, where people will be sort of monitored for the next, you know, 20, 30 years. And being able to measure biodiversity in somebody's home or in their workplace, in their farms, you know, what rodents are there? What species of bats are flying around? What lives in the roost? And how does that interact with health? And so we're really excited about having these tools, things like flies, but also these leaf swabs that give us sort of a tool to monitor biodiversity quite quickly. So you can sort of, you can leave a pack of swabs with somebody and say, hey, collect a swab once a month from your windowsill or the plant in your garden. And those kinds of tools really change our approach to measuring biodiversity, which is quite exciting.
That is really cool. I guess collecting the samples is very easy, but afterwards you have really big data, I guess. So like making sense of that data probably is the bottleneck of this whole endeavor, right?
Yeah. So the lab work at the moment is still kind of intensive. So it takes work. But if you think about like the rollout of large scale automation that happened during the corona outbreak, that, you know, you had testing in every town and every village, essentially. I mean, you had all of this automation that happened. So you had robots that were doing the extraction to speed things up. And with the swabs, if we really sort of shift to swabs now as a method, there's swab extraction robots all across the globe. And so scaling those things up may be more feasible than we thought. And the processing of those data is actually quite simple because it's a small, tiny barcode. Yeah. So it's really like a small little piece of some part of the genome of the animals that we're interested in. We often use the mitochondrial genome because you have many copies of mitochondria. Yeah. And so we target a small region that's different across the species that we're interested in. So if we're interested in mammals, we use a system that sort of amplifies mammal DNA, and then we have that short barcoding region. But doing the processing of that data is actually quite quick. So you can, on your own personal laptop, you can sort of compare those barcodes to a reference collection and say, okay, deer, you know, we had students who were collecting eDNA. So we have this sort of sci-fly, it's called the Citizen Science Project with Flies, and they can really process the data in part on their own, right? So they can blast a sequence and see, okay, here we had a bat sequence that came from the fly that I collected a week before. And so it can go quite quickly.
Yeah, I think it was with school pupils, right?
You just went to
the schools and yeah, really cool. So an easy thing also children can do.
And I think the leaf swabs are even easier. So we're shifting that citizen science approach now to also include the leaf swabs, because it's just, so collecting flies and having a bait and disinfecting the net, it's still a fair amount of work and sort of, you know, a bit of training that needs to go in. But collecting a swab of the vegetation is really something that's super minimalistic.
Yeah, you had to add that last part because otherwise you would not be needed as a researcher any longer, just to let the children do the work. We also mentioned already that, there's a lot of change on our planet now with the climate change and the decline in biodiversity. How does that affect the primate populations on our planet?
Yeah, so the majority of primate species that we know of are endangered. So they're threatened. So they have slow life histories, large home ranges. They're susceptible to many human pathogens. So there's a lot of things that sort of go against primates. They're also apparently delicious. So I've never eaten a primate, so I'm a vegetarian, but people who eat monkeys, they say they're a good food source and they're nutritious. And so there's many things that make conserving primates a challenge, especially in regions where there aren't so many resources. It's a tricky thing to do well. And environmental change is something that adds and compounds those challenges. So there's a paper that came out yesterday where they looked at how sort of heat waves influence the immune system of capuchins in Costa Rica. And they found that having those elevated temperature zones decreased immune system function of capuchin monkeys. And those kinds of, you know, things are probably going to be increasing. So monkeys who are not able to track the range because they can't migrate north to cooler climates, they're going to be living in warmer areas than they were, you know, 10 years ago, or rainfall. You know, they may be experiencing more or less rainfall. But these things are expected to have an influence on health and immune system function and disease load and the pathogens that can circulate in those populations. And so there's complicated predictions, and it's hard to make sort of a general rule of how all primates will do. But at the moment, primate populations across the globe are doing quite poorly. And sort of there's how that influences diseases and whether sort of there's these either feedback loops where things get worse, or if, you know, by having a lower density of monkeys that remain, that maybe that reduces the disease risk part, at least. Those are sort of open questions, but I would say for the most part, the primates that exist in the globe, they're doing poorly. So there's sort of a real conservation challenge.
Yeah, and if you're losing our primates, we are also losing these really complex ecosystems that you told us about and all their microorganisms. And we're also losing them as sentinels, because you also said, like, we can also look at the primates and have some conclusions for human health, maybe. Because, I mean, that's always the argument, isn't it? Like, if we can draw something out for humankind, then it's always
No, absolutely. And it's... We've done studies of primates in captivity, so to try to also study their microbiomes and their phagomes, and they completely shift. So if you take a chimpanzee into a captive setting, they lose a lot of their natural associated microbial diversity. So you have almost complete replacement of the phagome and the microbiome when animals are in captivity. And so that you really do lose that insight into that past, sort of insights into how the, you know, 6 million years ago, 8 million years ago, what was the human microbiome like? We're losing that. And, you know, it's kind of depressing, but probably there are many populations of chimpanzees and bonobos that simply won't exist in 100 years, you know, that we lose those populations. And all of those populations also have their own unique cultures. So that's sort of research that's sort of accumulating. So they have their own microbiomes, they have their own phage diversity, they have their own fungal associated communities, but they also have their own cultures and behavioral repertoire that's unique. And so, and that maybe leads also to that diversity of, so you have some groups that specifically hunt certain rodents or certain monkey species, so chimps who hunt certain animals or bonobos who hunt certain animals, and those also influence then microbial communities and what bacteria those populations have. And so it's not that we just need to maintain one population when we're thinking about sort of that maintaining that biodiversity, but ideally having many populations across the range that we can maintain.
Okay, so we should really speed up our conservation ambitions on the planet before it's too late and preserve these really, really fascinating living beings along with their microorganisms. Okay, so thank you very much, Jan, for giving us insights into your really interesting research work. I think it was a great example of One Health, because it showed like how everything is connected and how complex things can be. So thank you very much for sharing that with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity.
Dann sind wir am Ende dieser Folge und ich switche wieder zu Deutsch. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Wenn Ihnen diese Folge gefallen hat, dann lassen Sie uns gerne eine Bewertung da oder abonnieren Sie uns und schreiben Sie uns gerne an info@onehealthplatform.net. Wie gesagt, auch gerne, wenn Sie eine deutsche Übersetzung dieses Interviews wünschen. Die One Health Plattform ist ein Projekt des Friedrich-Löffler-Instituts, des Helmholtz-Instituts für One Health und der Universität in Münster. Gefördert werden wir durch das Bundesministerium für Bildung und Forschung.